Way News. I'm Victor Beatty. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko continues to express alarm over the potential of conflict with Russia following Moscow's seizure of three Ukrainian Navy boats and the capture of two dozen sailors. Monday, the Ukrainian parliament approved martial law for 30 days for regions bordering Russia. Petro Perkovsky is with the National Institute for Strategic Studies.
There will be actions which would allow law enforcement agencies and security services of Ukraine to disrupt Russian clandestine operations in the regions which will be under the martial law and which would prevent any attempts to destabilize the political situation.
Meanwhile, 12 of the 24 captured sailors appeared in a Russian court and ordered into 2 months of pretrial detention. Russia insists the Ukrainian vessels illegally entered territorial waters and ignored warnings to stop. Heather Nauert, a U.S. spokesperson, called it a dangerous escalation, called on European allies to do more.
Many governments have imposed sanctions on Russia for its actions in Crimea, in Ukraine. Not all of those sanctions, as I have been told and our experts have explained to me, have been fully enforced. So that is one thing that we can look for European countries to do more when we talk about doing more.
President Donald Trump said Tuesday he may not meet with his Russian counterpart at the G20 summit, depending on what a national security review of the incident concludes. Hundreds of Tunisians staged protests against visiting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Tunis. They chanted, "The murderer is not welcome," and are the first demonstration since the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi since he began his tour of the Arab world. This is VOA News. President Trump's chief economic advisor Larry Kudlow met reporters Tuesday to discuss the possibility of reaching an agreement with China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit to reduce trade tensions. He said Mr. Trump does not want to be a tariff president.
We want a world, ideally, of zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies.
Kudlow warned agreement with China requires several conditions to be met, including intellectual property theft, forced technology transfer, ownership of American companies doing business in China, high tariffs, non-tariff barriers, and cyber attacks. Israel's U.N. ambassador said Tuesday the U.S. hopes to unveil its Mideast peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians early in the new year. President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and envoy Jason Greenblatt have been preparing the plan since early in the administration. British Prime Minister Theresa May, ahead of crucial parliamentary vote on her Brexit plan in 2 weeks' time, has taken her case for approval to Northern Ireland.
What I'm doing, going around the country, is hearing directly from people, and I've had a very clear message here today in Northern Ireland, about the importance of this deal, the importance of the certainty that this deal provides, and that people don't want to go back to uncertainty and division, and it's that uncertainty and division that would happen if Parliament does not support this deal.
A large majority of parliamentarians oppose the agreement. French President Emmanuel Macron said he understands the anger expressed in recent fuel price protests, but vowed not to change course as he tries to move the country away from fossil fuels. Two have been killed, hundreds injured, in more than a week of so-called yellow vest protests. Protest spokesman Eric Drouet vowed more protests and road blockages Saturday. Mr. Macron said he also plans to close 14 of the country's nuclear power plants. China's President Xi Jinping arrived in Spain Tuesday. He'll hold talks with Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, a 3-day state visit focused on business deals. President Trump met congressional Republicans Tuesday to discuss a budget standoff that threatens a partial government shutdown by December 7. Mr. Trump insists Congress provide billions to build a border wall with Mexico. The U.S. Tuesday imposed sanctions on the wife of Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega and an aide, part of a crackdown on corruption and rights abuses. The government has been condemned for its crackdown on anti-government protests that have left hundreds dead. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Tuesday met with dozens of opposition members to discuss ways to reform the electoral system ahead of 2020 elections. Last week, he appointed a former opposition leader to lead the Electoral Commission. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda declared this Friday a day of mourning for victims of Saturday's boat tragedy, but the opposition wants answers.
Even this incident which occurred, there is no record of the exact what? Passengers. So we need the committee to come up and close all those gaps.
That's parliamentarian Waira James Manjigiri. Ethiopia's prime minister meets opposition leaders to discuss electoral reforms. South Sudan's finance ministry announces a national development strategy. And Rwanda's opposition leader says she's not bitter about her 8 years of imprisonment.
The dialogue that the opposition are asking today, that we can together find the solution of the many problems we have in our country, because they know that the political exclusion is not good for the country.
Victoire Ingabire is chairperson of the United Democratic Forces, FDU, in Kingi Party of Rwanda. 175 people are dead of cholera in northern Nigeria, and a traditional fisherman and fish shop struggle on Kenya's coast. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Ugandan government has declared this Friday as a national day of mourning for the more than 30 people who died last Saturday when a boat capsized on Lake Victoria. But some members of parliament say they want the government to come up with measures that will prevent such accidents from happening in the future. Mugumi Davis Rakorinji reports from Kampala.
Parliamentarian Waira Chewala Justingo James Majegele said the accident would have been prevented if the government had been more cautious. Majegele suggests the parliament sets a committee to investigate water transport within the country.
I always use a ferry, but we just bought the ferry. Even these MPs, I see them, we bought the ferry without any record, and that means there is a problem. Even this incident which occurred, there is no record of the exact what? Passengers. So we need the committee to come up and close all those gaps. The life jackets on that ferry, they are very few and very dirty. I've never seen anybody using those life jackets.
According to police records, only 27 people out of more than 100 who boarded the boat cruise were rescued. Stephen Mochitale, another member of parliament, says apart from saving lives, safety measures in water bodies will help boost marine tourism and earn revenues for the country.
Government must also put incentives to people who are doing investment in water transport. If I want to bring a good barge, if I want to get a good steamer, what do I get from government? Even if it means removing all taxes so that we can get the best investment. That's when we shall get Uganda as the best destination of tourism. That's when we shall have lakeside developments. You all want to go to Durban. You want to go to Cape Town. Because they have planned the water transport as the best model.
Prime Minister Rugunda says the government is well aware of the problem.
We as a country have a problem, and the sooner we address this problem and see how realistically we can deal with it within our own means, the sooner we can develop local capacity in terms of skills, in terms of training, the better.
This weekend, Uganda's President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni ordered for the electronic registration and monitoring of all the boats sailing on Uganda water bodies. The president said that he has previously sailed on East Africa's biggest lakes, Victoria and Lake Tanganyika, 5 times, on both occasions without life jackets, and that all the boats were overloaded. It remains to be seen if these measures will be implemented. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
It has been roughly 2 months and 12 days since prominent Rwandan opposition politician Victoire Ingabire was released from jail on presidential mercy. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ingabire said she will continue her political activism until Rwandans are saved from poverty and fear. Ingabire says she is not bitter about her 8 years of imprisonment. Instead, she said she's going to do more. Eugene Uwimara reports from Kigali.
Since her release from prison, Ingabire Victoire, the prominent critic of President Paul Kagame, has lived in the Kimihurura sector of the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Ingabire, the leader of the non-registered FDU Inhingi party, told VOA that she doesn't hold anger for her 8 years in detention because to attain the political space requires sacrifices.
It was not easy. The first 5 years I stayed in an isolated cell. It was in a dark cell, they said. I am not angry. I was not angry and will not be angry. If I see the problem we have, that we have no political space, I would like that the government today accept the dialogue that the opposition are asking today, that we can together find the solution of the many problems we have in our country, because they know that the political exclusion is not good for the country.
Ingabire says she's more determined about her political future and ambitions than before she went to prison.
Before we ask the registration of my political party, we need to talk with Rwandan people, which kind of problem they have. Secondly, you know that we have some members of my political party in prison. This would like first to see what will happen with them. If they will be released, then we can go ahead with the registration of my political party.
Ingabire Victoire says her party will join hands with other anti-Kagame groups. She says that President Kagame's regime could open peace talks with other opposition political players to address the issues in the country, including the lack of freedom of expression and poverty. But she said she's afraid that the government will not allow any of her opinions.
You're talking about political exclusion, but very recently the Minister of Foreign Affairs said, no, we don't recognize those parties.
That is exclusion, I talk about it. If the Minister of the Foreign Affairs says that he don't know FDE, he don't know RNS, he does not know, he knows who we are. That is the exclusion. You know that people are there, but you say, I don't know that they are there. That is the problem.
Why do you think he did that?
Because the government is not yet ready to accept the opposition in Rwanda. We are there to build our country. We are not there to destroy what they build, no.
Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza is a 50-year-old Rwandan activist and a chairperson of the United Democratic Forces, FDU Inhingi, a coalition of Rwandan exile opposition groups with a large base of active members in Rwanda, Europe, Canada, and USA. After 16 years in exile in Netherlands, she came back in 2010 in Kigali to run for the presidency against incumbent President Paul Kagame. She was arrested and sentenced to 15 years in prison on charges of terrorism and threatening national security. This year, on 14th September, she was released after President Kagame pardoned her. Ajahn Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
An Ethiopian opposition leader says opinions on whether the country should hold national elections in 2020 as scheduled are divided. Bayenin Petros, leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party, says there are those who believe that 2020 is a short time to have elections. On the other hand, Petros says other opposition parties believe time is not a factor, provided the electoral landscape is made accessible. His comments came after Ethiopia's new Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, met Tuesday with about 81 opposition parties to discuss electoral reforms. The meeting came also on the heels of last week's appointment of opposition member Betukan Medisa as head of the elections board. Petro says Tuesday's meeting and the appointment of Medisa are all good beginnings of the reform process.
The electoral reforms has already appointed a commissioner who was an ex-opposition party leader, a lady by the name of Betukan Medisa. Then he intends, her to guide the subsequent meetings with the political parties, and of course the ruling party included, on the way forward that would enable a fair, free, and genuine election in Ethiopia. And he expressed, his commitment to make sure that the upcoming elections would be such.
One of the complaints that opposition in Africa has had is that every electoral commission has not been democratic. It has lacked participation by opposition members. The appointment of Betukan Medisa is very important for the opposition. Would that be?
Yeah, it's a significant appointment. But the big question is reorganizing the electoral system or the administration from head office down to the polling station. This requires a huge contingent of representatives that would administer and oversee electoral activity. So it is not enough to have the best election commissioner. What matters is the professional core that would be needed to work with there, and also that garners the confidence of the, in particular the opposition, which has seen so much abuse in the hands of the cadres of the ruling party.
The EPRDF has ruled Ethiopia for some time now. Will the opposition be ready for these elections in 2020?
Well, there is a divided opinion. The time issue was also addressed. The participants, well, there are those who say, I think the almost now only 1.5 years left, a period of time will not be adequate for the parties to get organized, in particular those who just came into the country from exile to get registered. That has a process of collecting signatures from a minimum of 5 federal states, and again to go out and open the party structure in various parts of the country. So there is that opinion that the time leading up to the election, which is now almost only 1.5 years, will not be adequate and it needs to be extended. Even those opposition parties that have been trying to operate within, you know, we also maintain the position that the time factor is not that important. We want to see that the electoral landscape is made accessible, and that we are confident the way the electoral structure has been laid out by the new election commissioner and the government is at least agreeable, or that we are convinced the upcoming election will not be fraudulent as usual.
Beyeni Petros is the leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party of Ethiopia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Today is Wednesday, November 28th. Daybreak Africa time, 17:30 past the hour. South Sudan's finance ministry yesterday announced a national development strategy to restructure the government, invest in building roads and other physical infrastructure. The strategy also requires the government to resettle some of the hundreds of thousands of displaced people back to their homes over the next 3 years. As Mayan David Mayar reports from Juba, some lawmakers are skeptical the plan will work.
The 70-page National Development Strategy notes the country spent 10 times more on its military than any other country in the Sub-Saharan region between the years 2008 and 2015. The document says when the government spent 13% of its gross domestic product on buying weapons, very little money was left over to develop the country. South Sudan Finance and Economic Planning Minister Salvatore Grang Maburdit says that time is over.
We have been without a national strategy document to develop since the period of South Sudan Development Plan, which starts on 2013. It was for the period of 2011 to 2013. The NDS is therefore a very important instrument to convince the people that we are now back as one people.
Minister Maburdit says the revitalized peace agreement requests the government to come up with a development strategy that consolidates peace and at the same time stabilizes the economy. The new development plan requests that by 2021, the government establish a 40% increase in security, a 30% improvement in stability in commodity prices in the market, a 50% increase in service delivery, 80% improvement in food security, and a 70% return of refugees and displaced persons. The document says the lack of strong governance capacity since 2005 has been acknowledged by both the government and partners and is widely considered as a major contributing factor to the political and humanitarian crisis facing the country. Some lawmakers say they agree with the points made in the development plan, but doubt it will be implemented. One of them is Lual Deng, a member of parliament in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, who also heads the Ebonu Center for Research.
The National Development Plan 2011 to 2013, I believe, and the current National Development Strategy
They are good documents, but if they are not implemented, they are worthless. They don't even deserve the paper on which they have been written on.
Deng says if an entry doesn't meet technical, economic, environmental, and social criteria, it should be dumped. Lawmaker David Mayo, who chairs the Finance and Economic Planning Committee in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, says the strategy will work when South Sudan becomes stable politically.
I believe in realism. Realism is the science of nation building, and it's the science of international politics. Good politics equals to good economics, not the other way around.
Mabiurdit says national ministries will be required to form their budgets from the National Development Strategy. He says funding will come from oil and non-oil revenues. Mabiurdit says in order to meet the goals and objectives of the National Development Strategy, there must be a good governance that eradicates corruption and enables the allocation of public resources to respond to priority needs such as security, food security, health, and education. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayar in Juba.
A humanitarian group working in northern Nigeria says it has recorded 10,000 cases of cholera there and that at least 175 people have died from the disease since the start of November. The Norwegian Refugee Council says most of the cases were found in camps for displaced people in Borno State, where thousands seek refuge from Boko Haram attacks. Timothy Obizu reports from Maiduguri.
Closely built temporary sheds are the rule in this overcrowded camp in Maiduguri, where Yabusam Adam has lived with her family for 2 years. Recently, she lost her daughter to a deadly cholera outbreak here.
My daughter and I came to the camp, but she died from cholera. And we have been with my neighbors, but one of them was affected by the disease too. My 9 children and I stay here.
Congestion is a major trigger for the spread of cholera. This camp does not have enough facilities to serve the growing number of displaced people, creating a fertile environment for the disease to thrive, says one of the managers at the camp, Chima Onwe.
We have a lot of people living in just a few space, and these people have no limited access to basic services, mostly water, sanitation and hygiene services. Like latrines, so we have a case where people are congesting latrine, situation where latrines are congested and not usable, and the only option available for this large number of people is to defecate in the open.
It was not originally their wish to be crammed together here. Most of the displaced people here fled a Boko Haram onslaught on their homes to seek refuge. Children are more at risk from the disease. Once infected, they come down with acute diarrhea. This year, Nigeria battled its deadliest cholera outbreak, killing 434 people out of nearly 40,000 cases across 18 states. The head of the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, Chikwe Ihekwazu, says cholera may have been underestimated in Nigeria.
I think we've gotten to a situation in Nigeria where we've almost normalized cholera. We don't get upset about it enough. This is why here at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, we've really mounted a vigorous risk communication effort this year to make sure that every Nigerian understands the scale of the problem.
Cholera is a waterborne disease and peaks during the rainy season. The disease in northern Nigeria became deadlier since 2009 when Boko Haram displaced about 3.3 million people. And here in Maiduguri, the birthplace of Boko Haram, there are 243,000 people living in overcrowded camps with poor hygiene facilities. And unless more land is provided to expand the camps, Nigeria could be headed toward another massive outbreak next year. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Marine fisheries are one of the few economic activities present everywhere along the Kenyan coast, mostly using artisanal fishing methods in which non-motorized boats stay close to shore. In the coastal town of Malindi, thousands of households that depend on the fisheries resources face uncertainty over the sustainability of the industry. Rayal Ombuo reports from Malindi.
70-year-old Yusuf Abdulrazak started out as a fisherman in Malindi when he was young. Then, in 1978, he set up his own shop where, supplied by local fishermen, he would sell 500 to 1,000 kilograms of fish every day. He says in the last two decades, the daily catches have declined significantly. He now sells 100 to 150 kilograms per day.
We used to have a lot of fish here long before, but now the fish have declined. And the locals are the most people who suffer because they haven't changed their equipment. They're using the same old ones, which they've been left by their old people.
Yusuf is one of the many locals who rely on local fishermen not only to supply their shops, but also for food. Katama Mwaringa is a third-generation fisherman from Mijikenda, one of the oldest fishing villages in Malindi. His family moved there in 1903. He says their trade, passed from generation to generation, is under threat.
Zoni tulikuwa tunafaulu, lakini kufikia wakati huu.
We would catch fish, but things have gotten harder as the years go by. All we need is modern equipment or digital equipment that can help us get water from the deep seas so that we can succeed in our craft.
Mwaringa, like most locals, is too poor to own a boat. He uses a fishing net that is over 10 years old. The declining catches have resulted in low incomes and other economic difficulties for his community. Competition from prawn trawlers is also blamed for destroying the fishing ground, as they are accused of unintentionally catching and then discarding large numbers of fish that are not the species the commercial boats are after. Reliance on non-motorized fishing vessels and gear that cannot fish in deeper waters limits the quantity of fish that the traditional fishermen catch. Villagers from the Mijikenda village have come together and formed the Mijikenda Fishermen Association. 5% of each family's earnings is put in a collective fund that goes towards buying new fishing nets for the community to use. With the help of local NGOs, they have been able to fix solar panels in their village and buy a communal freezer to store fish. Professor Ntiba Micheni is Kenya's principal secretary at the Ministry of Fisheries Development. He says there are plans by the government to empower small-scale fishermen on the Kenyan coast to improve livelihoods. The
government is going to establish a Kenya fishing school, because if you are not trained to become a fisher, then we always find you at the shore and in near high water. And this is why the near shore waters, the artisanal areas, where many of the people concentrate their fishing, are overfished. So we need to train and also build capacity for Kenyans to be able to venture into deeper waters.
Kenya is hosting the first ever Sustainable Blue Economy Conference. Over 4,000 participants from around the world are coming together to learn how to harness the potential of the oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers to improve the lives of those who rely on those waters for food and income. For the artisanal fishermen in Malindi, it remains a struggle to survive. Raya Lombor for VOA News in Malindi.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Ugandan government has declared this Friday as a national day of mourning for the more than 30 people who died last Saturday when a boat capsized on Lake Victoria. But some members of parliament say they want the government to come up with measures that will prevent such accidents from happening in the future. An Ethiopian opposition leader says opinions on whether the country should hold national elections in 2020 as scheduled are divided. Beyeni Petros, leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party, says there are those who believe that 2020 is a short time to have elections. That is it for this Wednesday, November 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckfro, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, general elections are coming up in the Democratic Republic of Congo on December 23rd to determine a successor to President Joseph Kabila. An in-depth discussion on what's at stake in DRC's elections on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.